So where did you come from?
I grew up in Oklahoma.
Oh, that's a, kind of different.
Another frontier state. Mm-hmm. And then I studied on the East Coast and spent most of my 20s in Europe and came back. And I feel like a bit of a nomadic character. Mm-hmm. So I really, Minnesota is the place I've put down roots since childhood more than any place else.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I grew up here. I was born in southern Minnesota.
Right.
And I lived in Boston for 9 years and in Syracuse, New York, where I got my doctorate for 5 years. So that's kind of a different parts
good.
Of the country.
It's good to do that. How are we doing, Mitch? Do you want us to talk about what?
Breakfast.
Wait, tell me, did you have lunch? Tell me, did you have something?
I did have lunch. I ate about 11:30. And then I started doing some things on my computer, and all of a sudden it was 12:30. And I sort of raced along 94, but there was a lot of traffic, too. I think people are leaving for a spring break, probably.
Oh, that's probably right.
I think most of the schools have break coming up this week. We do, so lots of our students are heading off campus.
Mm-hmm. My children are not until the week after Easter.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Just tell me what you had for lunch.
I had a Brugger's bagel and a bowl of soup. I was starving, and also about 11:30.
Just gonna adjust this just a little bit.
Okay.
I think we're good.
Okay.
Wait till I leave the room.
I will.
And slam the door, and I will try not to clear my throat.
Well, you can clear. No, that's absolutely allowed. You can clear your throat. You can take a glass of water. You can stop. You can say something over again. Can we start talking? I did want to just start by hearing a little bit of your story. I noticed that you grew up in Minnesota, I've read this story that you received your first communion and decided that day to become a nun. Is that right?
Well, it was actually my confirmation, which is several years later.
Okay.
But the bishop was very concerned that our parish had not produced any vocations to either priesthood or to the sisterhood. Mm-hmm. And so he was scolding us on this day of confirmation. And I thought, well, I will see to it that something happens here, and I will become a sister. And of course, it went in and out of my mind through the years. But by the time I was in college, it came back very clearly.
While you were in college?
Yes.
And you became a Franciscan.
I did, a Franciscan from Rochester.
How did that happen? How did you gravitate towards the Franciscans?
Well, I went to St. Teresa's College, which is in Winona, and it was run by the Franciscans from Rochester. So it was a natural place close to home. And even at that age, it seemed far away, but it was just 30 miles away. And I liked the sisters very much. They were kind of free spirits, so it was an enjoyable time to get to know them. And it became quite clear to me that they were the group to join.
Mm-hmm. And then I was interested to read that your early academic work was in the field of cultural geography.
That's right.
What is that?
Well, geography is a study of any phenomenon from a spatial point of view. And cultural geography is a study of any aspect of a person's social life, education, racial distribution. It looks at any of those phenomena from the point of view of how they're distributed over space. So I did my research in India, in southern India, looking at literacy rates in rural India to see what factors contributed to literacy and what deterred from the development of literacy in a particular village.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any sense when you were studying cultural geography that you would be applying that discipline to seminaries and to education for priesthood?
No, I had no idea whatsoever. I spent 11 years after I finished my doctorate teaching and doing a little administration at our college in southern Minnesota at St. Teresa's. And then after that time, it was time overtime for a sabbatical. So I went to Boston to the Jesuit school there to study ethics. I had been on the board at St. Mary's Hospital, the Mayo Clinic Hospital in Rochester. Mm-hmm. And having done some work there, I saw the need for an understanding of ethical dimensions of medical issues, and so did my community. So I went there to study ethics, and I did that. And while I was there, the Lilly Endowment was looking for someone to write about seminaries. And so they wanted someone who had both a knowledge of theology, which I had gained, and a knowledge of the social sciences so that there would be an approach to the methodology that they wanted. So I was chosen to do that, and that's how it started.
And so you kept working in that ever since?
Right, building for on that. About 25 years ago, I think it is now, 24, 25.
So I think you can pick up a lot of newspapers or look back at articles that have been written about the Catholic Church in the last few years, and you will often find statements like this: the priesthood is in decline, or the priesthood is in crisis. And I just wonder how you, with all the experience and perspective you have on this, how do you begin to think through and respond to a large statement like that?
Well, the thing about the statements is that both things are true. There is some diminishment, and there's also some real growth and some real development in the understanding of what it means to be a priest and the education that's necessary. So certainly in terms of numbers, the decline is there. And there have been some other crises, as we are well aware, that have fed into these perceptions.
When you, I mean, I actually was quite boggled by all the numbers I saw, all the statistics. There are so many of them, so many different ways people have broken this down. But I mean, what are the statistics or the percentages that for you summarize, if not the crisis, the change in the numbers?
Well, the biggest change, I think, is the difference in the number of priests overall. 40 years ago, in 1967, there were about 60,000 priests. And now they're about...
In the U.S.
In the U.S., that's right. And now they're about 42,000. So that's a decline of 18,000. At the same time, the Catholic population has grown by probably 25 million. And so that is where the crisis comes in, because the numbers are simply not there to do the functions that priests have always done in the past.
I was reading a really interesting... reading about some sociological research that was done by Dean Hoag of Catholic University, and I think you've also written about his work, where he laid out the relative distribution of priests in the world and showed that while American Catholics have fewer priests than they used to, and that's a fact, they perceive that as a shortage, where in other parts of the world, where there are many Catholics, the ratio has always been, there's been even a wider disparity. And he talked in particular about Central and South America, where there's a six or eight times as much a gap between numbers of priests to numbers of Catholics. And he made this interesting observation. He said, in Latin America, which has never enjoyed a large number of priests, a style of priesthood has grown up over the centuries, which does not require as many priests. And he talked about family-based and home-based Catholicism as opposed to parish-based Catholicism, and where mothers and grandmothers might be the principal teachers and models, and there's not a felt need for necessarily for weekly mass attendance and frequent sacraments. Oh, that's fascinating.
That's absolutely right. The same kind of figures would be true for the continent of Africa and many places in Asia as well. So it is very true that there's a different style of priesthood. The question would be, what is the best way to serve the Catholic population? And this country, in recent years especially, that would be through the 40s and 50s, became very accustomed to having lots of priests around, plenty to be in each parish, even two or three. Several factors play into this, I think. One thing is the United States is a very large country, many spaces that are very open, and yet there are little pockets of Catholics here and there. It might mean that they would have no access to Mass or priests almost ever if we had that kind of ratio of 1 to 5 or 6 thousand Catholics per priest. So in that sense, we have that differentiation. And then once a country gets used to this kind of ministry, it's very difficult to change. And I think
the kind of ministry that
involves
Catholics
a lot of priests, right? And I think to suggest that in Latin America, Mass is not frequently celebrated. Many sisters that I know who have worked there are in places in the mountains where the priest comes two or three times a year. But that's not by any means considered the ideal. And so these people do depend upon family-based education, and the level of participation in the faith and so on is much different and perhaps much less.
Okay. So it's not necessarily, that's not necessarily a direction you look to say, well, maybe it's fine.
Not quite to that extreme. Okay. I think we probably could do with a better distribution of the priests that we have in this country, because there are some dioceses that have enough priests, let us say, or even plenty. And then there are some that are already very, very short.
And your work recently has been on one of the phenomena that's resulting from mm-hmm. this relative shortage, which is priests ministering in multiple parishes. Mm-hmm. How do you see that as? How do you think about that as significant? And how do you think about what it might mean for the health of the Catholic Church, the future of the Catholic Church?
It is a growing phenomenon. And in fact, now I would imagine it's close to half of the parishes, or about 20,000 parishes and missions in the United States. About half of those are covered by priests who have more than one parish. And it is distributed, in, especially in the upper Midwest and parts of the South, where the priest shortage is very much more felt. And so I think it makes such a difference in the way they are able to minister. And among the questions that I asked the priest in the book that I did and in the survey, about 1,000 of them answered, was how long did they think they could continue this kind of ministry, which on average involves driving at least 500 miles a month and involves lots of travel during the week and certainly on Sundays to provide the mass for the people in these scattered parishes. About a third of them said they could not do it more than 5 more years. Yeah. So that means...
Just in terms of human stamina.
Yes, human stamina. Right. And many of them, some of the ones who said they could go on for 15 years were in fact in their 80s, so I think that might be a little unrealistic.
Or maybe they made them differently.
Yes, who knows, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. So one solution that, in fact, in some surveys that I've seen, seems to be a step that is favored by a large majority of Catholic laity and a smaller majority of priests, is to think about making celibacy optional mm-hmm, for the priesthood. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, I wonder how you see that as a factor. Just let's start talking about it now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The question of celibacy and not having that requirement anymore certainly is talked about very widely as the number of priests continues to go down.
Is it mm-hmm. talked about also in the seminary internally?
Not so much. I think the young men who are currently in the seminary are very committed to living a celibate life. They go with the idea that this is what they will have to do for the rest of their life. And so I don't think they're talking about it as much as people who are outside of the seminary, truthfully.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it has been shown that this is a strong deterrent to Catholic college students who would decide not to think about the priesthood as an option.
That's right. And, of course, we don't know how many people we're losing exactly because of that factor. And the Church is holding very strongly to the idea of maintaining celibacy on the whole. Certainly there are a few married priests who have come from other denominations and become Catholic and so on. Mm-hmm. So, but generally speaking, the Church is very determined to continue this practice and provides, you know, a good deal of rationale for the reasons to do this.
I think people are often surprised when they learn the actual history of celibacy, that mm-hmm. in fact it didn't happen until the 11th century. It mm-hmm. wasn't something that came out of the earliest church. I mean, you can find mm-hmm. spiritual mm-hmm. teachings that seem to support it, but it was really more of a practical move than a theological move.
I think that's probably true, although some would say that it was really the 4th century that it became a more common practice. And then again, there's a 10th or 11th century view of history. So I think we don't have the exact science to know precisely what the practices were or how the Church was teaching about it in those earlier years. But certainly it has not always been part mm-hmm. of the teaching of the Church. And there were many practical dimensions to it. And over time, I think a rationale or a theological rationale has been developed. And I think that the young men who are studying for priesthood nowadays really see this as very much a part of their commitment, that it's a more singular commitment, that it is one that makes it possible for them to fully dedicate themselves to the ministry. That's partly practical, too, frankly. But this idea of being committed completely to the church and to Christ is very much part of their thinking.
And I don't know if this is something you've written about or if you want to take a stand on it, but I mean, how do you react to the idea of optional celibacy?
Well, you know, in my professional life, of course, I am teaching in a seminary, so I would very much be supportive of it there. I can understand the pressure that the church is under to change it. But, you know, personally, I wouldn't have an opinion I would want expressed, actually.
Okay. Well, I mean, let me ask you this, though. As a sister, mm-hmm, when you also mm-hmm. have lived yes. a celibate life,
yes, right. mm-hmm.
This is a virtue and a spiritual discipline mm-hmm, that you mm-hmm. have incorporated into your right. experience. I mean, how would you want to, what would you want to add in terms of your sense of the value of celibacy for ministry?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think celibacy has celibacy has a practical dimension, a personal dimension that is somewhat different from the practical ministerial dimension. On a personal level, how one relates to God, to Christ, I think comes out of who we are as a human being, and part of that is our vocational status. Certainly a married woman would be praying about her family, her children, concerned about her husband, and be living in that kind of a world, where as a sister, I'm living in a world that includes my community in a very important way, but my focus is perhaps more broadly on the people that I am ministering with and to. So in that sense, I think it changes the focus of my life a bit.
The clarity of focus mm-hmm, that it brings. Mm-hmm. And do you also see that as an advantage for the priests who you're involved in training, who you see coming out of seminary?
Well, talking to priests, you know, for many years now about their commitment and so on, I think many of them find it something that they can grow into. And it seems to be a little bit easier for older men to embrace this than it is for the younger men who really have to make it part of their life. They have to in a sense, gain the habit or the discipline that's necessary for to live this kind of a life. And I think it's a struggle for many of them. I think it may make them more available for ministry, but some would suggest that they might know more about some dimensions of family life and so on that could help them to be able to minister better in a family situation, for mm-hmm. example. So I think it has pros and cons, but the church still remains very clear about the need for it at this point.
And there is also the notion of expanding ordination to women. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And something that I've come to understand, although I think this may be a little harder for people on the outside of the church mm-hmm, to understand, mm-hmm. is that while there really is a robust discussion taking place about celibacy mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. whether it should be optional or mandatory and what it means, and you really see that as a dynamic, evolving conversation and an open public mm-hmm. conversation, ordination of women is in a completely different category. It's not something that is being discussed or is really open for discussion. Can you explain that?
Yes. Well, a few years ago, I think it may be as many as 8 or 10 now, a clear statement was made that this could not be considered, that is, women being ordained, nor should it be talked about as a possibility. And I think it did shut down a conversation that had begun in some ways.
Right. There was a statement of Catholic theologians. What
yes.
was it? The Catholic Theological Association mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or something.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Just saying that it should be open for discussion.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so I think after that statement, it has been very strongly disallowed, I would say, in terms of discussion. And so it might be privately discussed, but it would not be in the public domain in the way that it was before. So it has changed, yes. And I think women's attitudes about being ordained might have changed a little bit in recent years, too, with some of the problems that have been happening in terms of priesthood. It's not an easy profession, to be sure.
We'll say some more about that. I think it's Donald Sr. and other people have said mm-hmm. to me that there are a lot of Catholic women who would not want to be ordained into the priesthood as it now exists.
Yes. Well, I think, religious priesthood and religious sisterhood would have a lot of parallels in terms of community life and in terms of living the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And so I think for a woman who was a religious and in a religious community, that might be conceived as more possible or more compatible, perhaps. But to enter into a diocesan system, which is very much a male system and the hierarchical system, just doesn't suit the way most women approach life.
I will tell you that when we were thinking about doing a program about this subject of women's ordination, we decided not to, and partly because we couldn't get women inside the church, female, great female Catholic theologians, to talk about it, and that was a little bit shocking. They clearly had views on it, although they weren't necessarily predictable views. I think maybe people on the outside might assume, well, of course, all these liberated Catholic women would be for the ordination of women. That was not at all the case. They were really weighing this whole idea of ordination and what it means and whether that's even desirable, some of them.
Yes, I think it would be very difficult to do a program like that and to get a wide range of opinions of women, Catholic women theologians who are in good standing, because it really is not supposed to be talked about. So
right.
We are talking about it.
Right. Well, no, but this, they said to me, this is professional suicide. Yes. I won't go on the record. Yeah. All right, so I won't keep pushing you. I'm very interested in something that comes up in a lot of the literature, and you've written about this as well, about models of priesthood. And there are some categories, some ways of categorizing approaches to priesthood. A couple of them, cultic model, which characterized pre-Vatican II seminary training and a vision of what a priestly identity was and what the priest's relationship with the people was. And then something called the servant leader model, which started in the 1960s and certainly coincided with Vatican II, although I think there was the same shift in other Christian denominations as well, because we just suddenly had more of a sense of psychology and of the pastoral nature of that. So would you describe that shift?
Yes, it's been a big shift, and I think one of the very important moments when this servant leader model came into view was through a book written by a priest from the Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis, Father Robert Schwartz, and it was called The Servant Leader. And he wrote about that, of course, and then discussed it often at meetings and conferences, bringing out what some of the positive features of that newer model, or let's say a slightly different way of looking at priesthood, that had been emerging, I think probably for some time, maybe 20 years or so. It's hard to say. I'm sure there were priests who had that model even 100 years ago. But as a large-scale phenomenon, it came somewhat later. And I think what he was bringing out was the relational dimension of that model, that it required much more in terms of the priest understanding the lives of people, being able to converse with them about the problems of modern-day society, entering into the civic community, into parts of their lives that were not church-related necessarily, but where their lives were being lived, the ethical dimensions of their workplace. There were so many ways in which religious values needed to be brought alive through the priest's understanding of what was going on in a broader sense. So I think that was there. The older model, the cultic model, I think perhaps has been exaggerated in its in a kind of a negative way, in that it was seen as being separate and isolated and non-communicative.
Kind of up on a pedestal.
Up on a pedestal, right? That it was not. It meant that priests were very much above any of the Catholic people in their parishes, in education, in their spiritual life and values and so on. And so I think that notion just didn't work as well. And people, especially in this country, where, as you say, psychology was becoming part of the landscape, that people really wanted to understand their faith in a more personal way too. So it took a different kind of priest to be able to do that. What the young priest would say today, because there's some...
Right, because what's interesting is that there's now, and I want to hear from you, but there's some people say there's a shift back among the youngest priests to the cultic model.
Yes. The cultic priests of today are sometimes called sacristy priests or sanctuary priests, that their life is lived in the church. And that is a bit of an exaggeration, and I think it's a little bit unfair to portray it as drastically separating the two models. I think that a good priest today has to have some dimensions of both. Certainly a servant leader priest has to be able to have strong spiritual values that are expressed within the sanctuary as well, in his preaching, in the care with which he celebrates the Eucharist and other prayers of the church. So I think for anyone to say they are one or the other is not serving the church well.
This is another sweeping generalization, I think, that gets made, that the new generation of Roman Catholic priests is extremely conservative and very traditional, and also, some would say, intolerant and committed to reversing Vatican II. And how do you respond to that kind of generalization based on what you're seeing in seminaries?
What you portray is a strong and clear image of some seminarians and some young priests. And how many is a very good question. How long they remain that way after they leave seminary and get into a parish and begin to understand people's lives, that is a question we simply don't know the answer to any extent at this point, at least. So I think there certainly is a difference in the seminarians, even in the 25 years that I've been working with seminarians and in seminary education. And I think there is a trend toward what some nowadays are calling evangelical Catholicism. It is a strong commitment to the tradition of the church and a return to some of the practices like Latin masses and perhaps a more catechetical or apologetic approach to the doctrines of the church, which some people find to be very harsh and don't care for that approach at all. So there, that's present. It's more present than it was. I believe that could be documented quite well through the studies that have been done of seminarians by Dean Hoagie and others who have surveyed seminarians through the years. In my studies, I've interviewed virtually every faculty member in seminaries in the mid-1980s, mid-1990s. And in those interviews, I think the faculty would say that there is the kind of shift that I am describing. Perhaps part of it is that many, and in the most recent survey, 75% of seminarians said that they experienced some sort of conversion at the time they chose to enter the seminary. Now, those conversions were occasionally from one faith to another, from one denomination, from a Christian denomination to Catholicism. But more often it was a reconversion to Catholicism. They hadn't been practicing and now they were coming back, or they were now going to practice more intensely.
So you have the zeal of the convert.
Yes. So I think that is
a
very
large
factor.
I've never heard that as an explanation.
I think that really enters into it. I was estimating it at half to two-thirds, and then the survey showed 75%. So I think there is definitely something to that. There is a mentality in which these young men are entering their priesthood that is coming out of a newness of their faith and an insecurity with their faith that makes them a bit rigid at times, and that they don't necessarily have the lived experience of people who have been Catholic all their life and been practicing all their life and see the largeness of the Catholic Church. Sort of, I call it the magnanimity or the extensiveness of the Catholic Church. There are many ways to be Catholic and be good Catholics. And I think some of them think there is exactly one way and they know which way it is.
It's very interesting that you describe that. I know I've heard people informally speculate, perhaps on the basis of not much, many studies, but speculate that that the reason so many younger priests seem to be so much more conservative is that it's only the most conservative Catholic families who would be raising their sons to enter the priesthood. You're suggesting that instead, at least maybe part of the dynamic, is people raised in our culture, which has become secularized, and even Catholic families, which have become secularized, and that these are young people who are reacting to that by becoming more religious. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I don't think it's true that all or very many seminarians come from a very, very strong Catholic background. Certainly some of them do. There is no doubt about that. And again, in my studies, I thought of 25% to 30% who were coming from a family where the faith was very strongly practiced and lived out, and they went to Mass every Sunday. So there is that. There is that dimension certainly present. But the larger number would not fit into that category. So it's true. Now I've lost my train of thought.
that the picture is bigger than that, that it's not just about their families of origin themselves being extremely conservative mm-hmm. and traditional.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And a study that just came out last summer called American Catholics Today by several authors, including Dean Hoagie and Mary Gauthier from CARA, the Center for the Study of the Apostolate. These studies show that in terms of commitment to the Catholic Church and in terms of identifying as a Catholic, this younger generation who would now be entering the priesthood, it's called the millennial generation, basically now they're in their 20s. This group of people only has 7% who, according to several of their measures, would call them strongly identified and committed to Catholicism. And I do believe that...
You mean that in the general population?
In the general population.
Population of people who've grown up in Catholic families.
That's right, yes. Right. So I do think that by the time they enter the seminary, that 7% is where most of them come from, including many who have been converted. But by the time they convert, they really become these very strong, strongly identified and strongly committed young men. And so even though their upbringing may not have brought them to this point, their conversion did bring them to this point. So they are coming from that group by and large.
Now, some of the analysis of what went wrong in the midst of the clergy sexual abuse mm-hmm. crisis of the last few years traced it back to that rigid, traditional, cultic, priestly formation of the pre-Vatican II era. Do you feel, and this was a culture of power and secrecy and... Do you worry that younger generations adopting some of those ideas of priesthood that they then present a danger for some of the same mistakes mm-hmm. happening, the same things going wrong?
Yes, I'm actually part of that John Jay study of the sexual abuse crisis, and I think there could be something to that. We just don't have the kind of research I wish we had. The those who were abusers, many of them did come of age at the time that the seminaries were very rigid. There's no doubt about that. But there have been some in more liberal times, too. So we can't say it's absolutely that factor, though it seems to me the secrecy and the lack of transparency about who they are as individuals probably wasn't as clear as it is now. Even if these young men nowadays are... wanting to return to the more traditional, they are really required to be more transparent about their lives. For example, they have an individual spiritual director and an individual formation director and an academic advisor usually. So several people are working with them and get to know them very well. And part of the requirement to move on through the seminary is that they be transparent about their lives, that they not have a hidden life. And, of course, people can still do that, but it takes a lot when you have a lot of people
harder.
Surrounding you.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any kind of oversight like that in previous generations.
No, and I think in previous generations there were very large classes in seminaries, for one thing. There wasn't the individual knowledge of the person. And I think that... the idea was that they were supposedly studying. I don't think that they spent very much time at all focusing on the meaning of celibacy in their lives, the sacrifice that this would be. It is not a small thing to make this choice of life. And so they didn't really focus on that. And it went through sort of in a lockstep class way. Archbishop Roach wrote to me after I did some work on some articles on celibacy and what's being done in seminaries today, which is very extensive education on this topic. And he said, if only that had been the case when I was in the seminary, and he would have been of an age where mm-hmm. he would have been going through in those more difficult times. So I thought it was interesting that he found that to be such a lack of in his own life and in the lives of many people his age. So I think there were things missing, certainly, in that other era, but it does not guarantee that even with the best of education, there won't be people who will fall.
Mm-hmm. There's kind of an interesting dynamic, maybe a paradox, in the big picture of ministry and vocation in the Catholic Church mm-hmm. now. On the one hand, there seem to be there's some movement towards what is traditional, and maybe these more conservative priests who I suspect among their traditional values are very committed to the male celibate priesthood. I'm just guessing, but I think those mm-hmm. are among the traditional values. And then you have 9 out of 10 parish life coordinators are women. One of the results of the shortage of priests has been a greater participation of lay people of all kinds. And you also have lay people at seminaries, at Catholic seminaries, though they can't be ordained. They might be married people, they might be women. When did that start to happen? Have you watched that all unfold over the last few years with interest?
That is when the women entered into the pastoral ministry.
Lay people entering seminary even.
Yes. I just did part of that in an article that I did, so I'm sort of up on it. The first lay people to enter seminaries in any numbers at all was in the 1970s. And they were first even measured, I think, in the 1980s. That is, there was a roll taken of how many there actually were enrolled. And it took until about 1990 to get a full picture of lay people actually participating fully in programs, sometimes programs designed for their benefit and for the kind of ministry that they would have that would be slightly different from that of the priest. And so I think it's about a 20-year-old phenomenon at most in terms of any numbers. There are about 2,600 lay people now studying in seminaries for professional ministry, and many others studying in other settings, but in seminaries it's that number. And there are only about 3,300 seminarians, so it's getting close to 50-50.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, when you look at Catholic identity and the health of the church, I mean, how do you see all these pieces adding up?
Mm-hmm. I think if priests are open to collaborating with women and lay men in their parishes, and if they treat them as, if not equals, at least as someone who is a strong partner with them, it really works out very well in many, many cases. And the teams that work together and do different parts of the ministry, their roles, I think, are suited to their backgrounds, to their family situations, and so on. I think it can be even better than it was before. But when the priest doesn't want to cooperate with lay ministers and sees them more as working for him than with him, and this is one of the problems with the younger priest, being free enough and secure enough to be able to really share in the ministry in a more or less equal way. Granted, the pastor is always in charge, but there's a difference in the approach that can make all the difference in the world as to the quality of ministry that's provided. And many of these large parishes around this part of the country, any place, they have teams of up to 30 or more people, lay people, working with one or sometimes two priests.
Right, right.
And so if they can't work well with them and can't get everyone on the same page, it's not going to be very successful ministry. A priest simply cannot manage a parish without very good working relationships with his co-ministers.
It strikes me that a lot of what's gotten a lot of attention in recent years are moves that seem to be I don't, I think reversal is too big a word, but somewhat in defiance of the spirit of Vatican II. And and yet John the 23rd's commitment to the priesthood of all believers, if you look at the big picture of the Catholic Church of the United States, it seems to absolutely be becoming true. I mean, that in fact, the heart and soul of even parish life is about so much more than the priest by necessity, just because of numbers.
Yes. I think the involvement of people in parishes today compared to, let's say, 50 years ago or so is enormously more enormously greater and more effective. I think people who actually go to church are much greater oh, I'll think of a word for that. Well, I think people who are attending church on a regular basis these days are deeply involved not only in the church services but also in the outreach that comes from a dedicated person with great values. They are great in serving in the community. The parishes do work in ways that reach out to the poor, to people who are disabled, and all kinds of people who really need help in a way that was not done before. The parish of old, I think, was much more centered on itself and its school and its own people. And now there's, I think, a much greater outreach. And that, to me, is a very healthy thing. Part of that is brought about by more and more lay people knowing the community situation, who bring these needs to the attention of the others in the church.
You've also spoken about this, a basic challenge to the future of the Catholic Church and ministry in just how to inhabit, how to have an identity of the church in a pluralistic and multicultural society. Talk to me about that. Talk to me about that challenge.
Yes. The Catholic Church has been growing at a rate of about 500,000 per year in the United States in the last 30 or 40 years. And much of that growth has been of immigrants coming into this country.
Hispanic immigrants.
Hispanic
mostly,
largely,
right?
But Asian, a very large Asian Catholic population as well. In the past, the immigration was from Europe, and so it blended into the existing society. But with these new immigrants, they have different needs in terms of ministry, and sometimes they end up in the same parish. So people within a parish have to learn how to get along with each other, even if they don't speak the same language, and gradually they have to appreciate each other's customs and ways of worshiping and participating from a much more enthusiastic, perhaps, liturgy that would be common among
Hispanics. Right, because
Hispanics.
There's that big charismatic influence from Latin America.
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. And those who like a staid, quiet liturgy are probably not going to find that very easy. So I think we're in a time of transition that makes it both dynamic and difficult to be ministers, because you have to keep people together and at the same time serve a lot of different needs. So I think the young men who are being educated for priesthood and lay ministers equally must be aware of the broad spectrum of people that they're serving.
And is that part of the training now at the seminary where you teach? Is that integrated into the curriculum?
It is integrated, and we have some wonderful programs, as do many parts of the country, especially for Hispanics. But I would say we have not done as well for African Americans, who, of course, are much longer part of the fabric of the Catholic Church, small numbers, but nonetheless very dedicated people. We have not done as much for Asians. I think language difficulties there are much greater, where with Hispanics, lots of people are learning Spanish, and it's part of the larger culture besides just being the church culture.
Oh, right.
So that helps.
The demographics, the percentage of Hispanic citizens altogether is also large.
That's right.
And as it projected into the future.
So our seminarians are, many seminarians across the country, are expected to learn Spanish as a second language, learn it well enough at least to celebrate the sacraments and Mass in Spanish. They're expected to live with Hispanic families and communities to get a sense of what that's like, to see the differences, the family values that are so great in these settings, and to realize that we have something to gain and not just something to give. And that takes a while to accept.
That's interesting. I'm going to read your own words back to you. This was an interview you gave with U.S. Catholic. You said, "There's something about the Catholic faith that is utterly resilient. I do believe in the Spirit. The older I get, the less I think I'm going to live into the fullness of the resilience that I know will come. What are you talking about there?
The fullness of the resilience is the question. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that right now we are in a place that is less than thriving for the Catholic Church. There are so many tensions and so many disagreements among people. Some of them you've pointed out in terms of ecclesiology, in terms of the way some of the leaders interpret, that is, young priests especially, interpret how the faith is to be lived out. People have disagreements about how they will accept others' ways of worship and spirituality and so on. So I think we're living into a new period of time when we will gradually recognize that lots of people have gifts to give and that they all do fit in this very large tent that is the Catholic Church. And I think a little more relaxing about meaning of being Catholic. It is not so clearly defined, not in terms of doctrine. Those are doctrines and dogmas are clearly defined, but ways of being, I think, are something else. The way we worship together and so on. I've been around the world and seen so many different expressions that are deeply reflective of the wonderful cultures of different peoples. And I think to appreciate that more is what we really need. Cardinal Bernardin's effort of the Catholic Common Ground Initiative.
And you were close to his work close to his legacy,
that's right.
I think.
Mm-hmm. That the Catholic Common Ground Initiative really had as its goal to help people to be able to talk more civilly with each other, to be more respectful of differences within the church and among people of different age groups and different backgrounds and different approaches to the church. And that has not taken off as much as I had hoped it would. So I think the fullness is to come when we are more accepting of others and where we see God's work in people in much broader ways than we might see it right now. At least some people might see it or want to define it so narrowly. And I think the struggle about Vatican II is at the heart of this.
You mean how the current deliberation on how to interpret that,
yes,
how to carry it forward?
Right. Is Vatican II, is the interpretation of Vatican II today a misinterpretation, and that in fact the faith has been weakened, or is it a fact that we have not yet fully accepted or lived into the meaning of Vatican II? I would suggest the latter, that we have much to learn from the documents of Vatican II. Even yet, when I go back to those documents, so many of them that speak to today's world in so powerfully, and we have kind of put them on the shelf.
Do you think of one in particular?
Well, Gaudium et Spes, I think. The hopes and joys and the struggles of people, that this is recognized so clearly in that, and that we are all trying to come to God, and that we are trying to do this in our own way, and that we need to recognize in every person their own struggle and their own desires and hopes, mm-hmm, and not just see it from our own point of view.
Something that strikes me, I've spent a lot of time with Benedictines.
Oh, yes.
And mm-hmm, from them, mm-hmm, and I think this is very Catholic, but it was from them that I learned about a way of approaching time and history that's, mm-hmm, quite different, mm-hmm, than our, mm-hmm, culture. I suspect that you have the same kind of mentality as a Franciscan. Mm-hmm. You think in terms of hundreds of years,
yes,
and change,
yeah,
in terms,
mm-hmm,
of centuries and not, mm-hmm, months.
Mm-hmm.
And so, all right, in the context of American history, I suppose the 1960s seems like a long way away, mm-hmm, ancient history, mm-hmm, but really it's just 40 years.
Yes, right.
And in the context of a 2,000-year-old tradition, knowing Catholics as I do, it's really not very long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it strikes me as I've been getting into the delving into this, thinking about this particular, these interviews in this program. This is a place in terms of interpreting Vatican II, living with it, where the American mindset is in tension with the Catholic mindset, mm-hmm, just in terms of, mm-hmm, of how long things take,
yes,
and how long it really takes even to know, to be able to answer that question, what did it mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
That's right. I think there are two streams of time going on at the same time. I think there is that longer view of history that, in fact, is how the Second Vatican Council will be lived out, that this will take another 100 years or so to understand really exactly, or if we ever can understand exactly, I don't know, but to understand more clearly what it is that really brings about the kingdom of God more effectively. and what makes people more dedicated to their faith and therefore helping others and doing the kinds of things that we hope come from living out our faith. So that's one side. And then there is that short-term thing of, well, we've made some changes. They were not good changes, so we have to change back really quick.
Right.
And so it's that...
There's two ways to go, forward and backward.
Yes, right. And so that's the kind of... They're not parallel tracks. They may be parallel in terms of they're both about time, but one side of the track is going way far ahead of the other one, and the other is just slowly absorbing and looking at and seeing what will come from this. We know that from the Council of Trent, which they say took 400 or 500 years. The other part that's, I think, just hugely having a huge effect right now, the other dimension that really makes a difference in how we understand the church and understand each other is the communications and the technology. So much can be known immediately. Like, nothing is said that is not immediately known by everyone, it seems, any kind of statement by the Pope or whatever. And I think this is affecting the students sometimes not so well.
Your seminary students?
Seminarians, yes, because seminarians tend to know exactly what the Pope said about this, that, or the other thing. And even sitting in class, I see them sometimes on their computer when I say something and say I'm quoting the Pope, they'll be looking up to be sure that I'm really quoting the Pope. It's, there's a kind of checking on people that's possible with technology that's not so positive. The good thing is that there are many resources available, but the bad thing is that it's become sort of a detective system.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think that this this Catholic sense of time is probably important when, let's say, the culture, Western culture, American culture, women are in all positions of leadership in Western culture now, and but I have observed that that Catholic women do possess this Catholic sense of time, even when they think about an issue like the ordination of women, even if it's something that maybe they long for. They don't have the same expectation that it should happen so quickly. They understand that kind of change simply doesn't happen quickly in an institution like this.
Yes, I think there are women who are patient in that way and who do see things.
And there are women who are impatient,
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly, right. It's probably that same two different tracks of time or two different understandings. But yes, the Catholic understanding would be whatever changes will be made will be over a long period of time, and whatever understandings will come, we will keep hopefully getting clearer and clearer, but we may also have some steps backward where things fade and we lose track of some good that was there. So it's a back and forth. That's part of what we live with.
I think that's interesting that you talk about the seminarians in some ways having a more immediate relationship with the Pope's words because of global technology.
Yes.
And then at the same time, there's also a tension between this vast Catholic structure of authority and hierarchy, even the idea of a Pope, in a sense, that is at odds, that is somehow in tension also with just American democratic culture.
Yes, I think that's a huge difficulty in the church maintaining itself these days and keeping membership. As we know from that Pew study, almost a quarter of adults, Catholics, the new Pew study, as of a month ago, shows that about a quarter of Catholics have left the church as adults. And that is probably because they don't like the more structured hierarchical system. The democracy, the democratic dimensions of all of this have really taken hold in people's thinking, and they can't seem to see their own freedom within that. And yet I think there's a great deal of freedom possible, but people read things differently as the law comes down or so on, and how it applies to them. Italians are famous for their more lax interpretation of things. And I think Americans are very literal sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And then we're surrounded in the rest of culture by a very strong evangelical Protestant system that is just very much into the literal interpretation of Scripture and a very strict living out of their lives. And so it's kind of almost a competition for some. We can be as good as they are, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think all the culture surrounding us has a great deal to do with how we practice our faith and understand it, and it can be for the good or bad.
Hmm. I'm curious if you, it looks to me like your first major study, Reason for the Hope, you published that book in 1989, and then you, again in 1999, mm-hmm, you published mm-hmm. some more research, and you've continued to mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to do different kinds of research on seminary training in particular, but really the future of ministry and the future of the church. And I'm curious if you look back, are you surprised at how the questions you were asking at different stages, the sources of despair, the sources of hope, has there been a lot of change in those that you might not have been able to predict or that surprises you as you look back mm-hmm. now?
One of the things that stands out for me in the differences between the, let's say, about mid-80s and mid-90s when I was doing the interviews, and that was hundreds of interviews for each, in the 80s, the leaders of seminaries were talking about how they could better implement Vatican II, how this teaching of the council could be incorporated into their classes, how it could be made part of the way people were trained to do their ministry, how they would be visiting parishes more often, going out to understand the larger culture. That was very much the direction that it was taking. I suppose it's part of that servant model of priesthood. That was the main issue. How can we be better at helping people to enter into Vatican II? By 90s, that was not mentioned much at all. In fact, it was the tension that had grown up around Vatican II and around the teachings, and were they really being correctly interpreted, and the division that was evolving or beginning to show up in seminaries between faculty members, and it's now even more intense, where there is a new breed, fairly large group of young faculty, both lay and young priests, who are very much in the more strict interpretation and seeing Vatican II as having been destructive to the church in some ways. So their teaching of it now is quite different from that of the older faculty, and there's a tension around that that the students have to somehow work out. And I think it's fine that they do, because it's also the tension that they have to work out in the larger church.
Hmm. Does this concern you? Do you worry about the effect on the church of this? But of this new, it sounds like more of a hard line that is there among students and teachers.
Mm-hmm. Well, to the extent that the hard line approach, so to speak, is causing people to be less committed to the church, and it's causing people to move away from the church, really concerns me deeply. There is a stream of thought, and I don't know how widespread, I hope not too widespread, that it would be better if we had a smaller number of more faithful people in the Catholic Church. And I just don't think this is according to the gospel. Go out to all nations, bring in all people, go to every town and village. And I find this other direction of let's really round up the troops and be very disciplined and very strict about who is in and who is out and what's good and what's bad. That can go overboard. It's not that we can't be faithful to the teaching of the church, but that it doesn't have to be so rigidly understood. And also that one has to be immediately perfect rather than that this is a lifetime struggle of moving toward God. I'd like to see more of that. So I think there are some dangers to it. And it does discourage some people in parishes. We know that from feedback that we get. I'm doing research right now of some of the changes in parishes when a new pastor comes and what happens when he tries to turn the parish into something that it has not been.
And you hear stories about that
too. Yes, Our Broken Parish is an article I just read that was, I think it was in America. It was a very poignant story that is repeated often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that that Pope Benedict has spoken along those lines. I think he says that truth is not necessarily decided by the majority. And of course, he's being influenced by the context of European culture, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. where the church is really much more embattled and isolated than it is here in general. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, the church, mm-hmm, right, all churches, right, yeah. Religion in general,
exactly,
let's say.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense, and he has not been Pope very long, but mm-hmm. we're doing this mm-hmm. program mm-hmm. on the occasion of his visit, and it's really not about him, but I mean, do you have a sense from within a seminary of how this papacy is affecting seminary education, or is it even possible to say something at this point?
At this point, and this Pope, let's start over.
Okay.
this Pope has written relatively little for the time that he has been in office. I think it's going on 3 years, or will be by the time he comes here. And he has written, I believe, two major encyclicals and a few other shorter writings. But Pope John Paul II wrote constantly and had dozens of encyclicals. And so his thought is still predominating.
Hmm.
And I think
sort of percolating through things.
Yeah,
still.
This Pope has been much more restrained in what he has written. And they've, God is Love has been an encyclical that was most encouraging to people, I think.
His first encyclical.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Can't think of the name of the second one. But.
It was on hope, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Those themes, hope and God is Love, are certainly themes that people really appreciate.
Gary Wills is somebody who has been a mm-hmm. critic of the papacy, but here's something he says that is intriguing. He says that Rome has this power to attract energies and generate energies around the symbol of Peter. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask mm-hmm. you this question mm-hmm. on a personal level. What is that? What is that power of Rome, that symbol of Peter? What mm-hmm. does that mean mm-hmm. in your life and in
yes.
your faith?
For me, there is something about the truth of the Catholic faith, which I firmly believe in, that is centered somehow in the person of the Pope, because it is through him that the Church understands itself. And therefore, what the Pope does and says is so important to my faith, to anyone's faith as a Catholic, I think. It is the only religion, really, to speak of, that has such a central person who is so important. And while I may chafe at this or that particular statement that is made, ultimately, I want to be challenged and guided by what the Pope says, because this person, I believe, is very particularly selected by God to be the leader. That centrality of leadership, while it has its difficulties at times, is also what makes the Church what it is. We can look to a place where the faith is held, and then we take that faith and hold it in our own hearts in different ways, perhaps. But at least there's always that central place to go back to. So Rome has a very strong hold.
It's a rather mysterious kind of description mm-hmm. in modern ears,
mm-hmm,
I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Reasons for the Hope was the title of your 1989 book. What comes to mind when I just use that phrase with you, reasons for the hope, as you think about the future of the Catholic Church? What are mm-hmm.
At the time that I wrote that book, I searched for a title, and this idea came from Ephesians. When I wrote this book, I was searching for a title, and this particular title came from the letter of Peter. And in it, he is speaking about we have to be able to say to people what is the reason for the hope that we have coming out of the resurrection of Christ. And so it seemed to me to be a time that we wanted people to be able to articulate why their faith was important to them, why there was hope in their life. And I think it was a time in the Church when there was a great deal of anticipation of a great future for the Church. And so it seemed to me that we had in seminaries at that time a body of teachers and of students who were really going to be participating in this new hope that was to come about.
And now, does that phrase have different connotations, or does it bring different images or ideas mm-hmm. to your mind?
I think there's still reason for hope, as always, but I think that the reasons may be different from what I would have thought of in those days. I think there are reasons to hope that we can educate these young people, men who are studying for priesthood, and lay ministers in a way that will help them to really change the Church for the better, really help them to meet people's needs in a spiritual way. Probably one of the biggest sources of hope nowadays is the way that lay Catholics have come to the fore, have really stepped forward to take their place in ministering in the Church. The number of sisters has dropped over the years by 110,000, the number of priests by close to 20,000. And so we have very few, relatively speaking, of professed ministers in the Church, either as priests, sisters, or brothers. And now we have over 200,000 lay people who are working full-time for the church, either in Catholic schools, a very large number, 165,000, and about 30,000 full-time professional lay ministers. Where have these people come from? They have been educated, and they have taken over these jobs that are not very well-paying necessarily, generally not, and they have taken their place to forward the Catholic Church in a marvelous way. So I think we're in pretty good places with the future of the church, given the willingness of people to step forward.
Hmm. Okay, I think that's it. You know, I wanted to ask, this is not the last question, but I, I know I'm not the first person who's noted this with you, but it would seem that there's some irony that you are one of the great experts on Catholic seminary education, and you yourself would not be, could not be ordained. And that's
is that a question?
Just wonder how you react to that.
Yes. You know, I think I'm extremely happy in my life. I really love being a religious sister. My community means the world to me, and in that community, I have had opportunities spiritually and professionally that are just astounding and would never have happened to a farm girl from Wabasha without having been part of that. Nowadays, it might be different. There might be other routes, but I had a wonderful opportunity to have a rich, full life. And my desire for priesthood, or my not being able to be a priest, isn't something I even think about. It isn't a profession that I would particularly find one that I would want to enter. I love doing research and study and teaching, and priests nowadays, diocesan priests, are not able to do that very much at all, only a few of them. And religious priests could, but then so can religious sisters do the things that I'm doing. So I suppose in some sense, some people say to me, it's a loss that people like you can't be a priest. And I say, well, I think there are so many ways I can serve that suit me just really fine. But I know not everybody feels that way. There are women who feel that they really want to be a priest. Yeah. I tend to be more introverted, and I think the work of priests, a diocesan priest, is extremely extroverted. So I think there's a lot that goes into it personally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I could not ask you. Let me see if there's some questions from behind the glass. It came up, I think, in a fine way. Mm-hmm. Okay, this may be kind of a big question. Let me ask it this way. If you think about priesthood at its best, from the experiences you've had in your life in the church, what kinds of people come to mind? Have there been formative figures for you who kind of epitomize that?
Formative for me or formative?
For you, yes.
Priests. I think the priests who have made the most impact in my life are priests who were present at times of illness and death in my own family. I think they are priests who were available to people who really had great needs that they had spiritually, that they were able to feel so much better about themselves, that they were able to turn around their marriages, that they were able to live a more healthy, fruitful life, that they brought joy to the lives of people. Priests who celebrate the Eucharist, celebrate liturgy well and preach well, touch my life spiritually, continue to do so. And I think they have the most impact on people because that's where most Catholics meet the priest, is at Mass. And so preaching to me is one of the most important things. And then that personal ministry that comes at times of crisis in people's lives or at times of joy, marriages and births and baptisms and so on, but especially at times of crisis. I think priests who can step into those situations, Catholics still rightly think of that as moments when they can really be comforted by God's presence through the priest.
Okay. All right. Great.